Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking about Manchester United's draw with Tottenham and delving a little deeper into Jim Ratcliffe's involvement at Old Trafford. We'll also be talking Chelsea, Manchester City and remembering the oddest things we've seen at a football match. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have two of the finest writers and football journalists in the land, Matt Dickinson and Alison Rudd, and a former footballer who, in his first season playing in defence for Nottingham Forest, had a pretty poor record. Played 20, lost 11, drawn 7, 1-2. Sorry, mate, I just thought I'd dig you out. It's Blue Monday, isn't it, apparently?
That was low, that one. That was the saddest day. That was harsh.
It's a bit of a lazy one, but maybe I'll go through your career next time and find a really good season.
No, I wouldn't encourage that either.
A difficult season for you, and it's been a difficult season for Erik ten Hag and Manchester United. Quite a few draws for Gregor, and it was a draw at Old Trafford, which has actually been rare for his side. Leading twice, Alison. It's Monday morning. It's time for my favourite question on the podcast. What did we learn? Did we learn more about Tottenham in this draw, or did we learn more about Manchester United?
Oh, we learned equal amounts about both, but they were things we already knew.
Yep.
So, Spurs heavily depleted, their most exciting flair. Oh, I'd love to sign them players. We're all missing, and yet they did what we expected them to do, which was play as if there was no crisis whatsoever, because that's the Ange stamp, isn't it? That it doesn't matter. There could be some sort of hostage situation at the training ground. He would send out the cleaning staff who hadn't been able to get in that day to play a match, and he'd make sure they played attractive football. So that was what we already knew. But another chapter in the Ange playbook. Manchester United, I'm not sure I've ever seen a team play so passively, given that there was so much hype beforehand that Jim Ratcliffe was going to be there. There he was, sat next to Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, the old dynasty, the new dynasty. And you've got a man in a bobble hat who can't even get out in time for the start of the second half. And he misses the early Spurs goal, which is like a proper sort of metaphor for everything that's wrong with the club. Is he spending too much time, I don't know, where is he? On some sort of laptop, doing some sort of analytics instead of remembering there's an actual game going on. There is a fear permeating the team. And yes, they scored two goals at Old Trafford. But really, really, given the context, given their opponents were depleted, how come it was the visitors who had the ball, who took control? All United seemed to be doing was just waiting for a mistake.
Gregor, lots of points made by Alison there. I think they strayed slightly more onto the Manchester United side. So I'll come to you about Tottenham. It is impressive what Alison talked about in terms of getting a lot out of these players. Like Richarlison, for example, struggled for a long time, seemingly stepping up, scoring goals from set pieces. After that little dip around the kind of Christmas period, this has been a positive period for Ange Postecoglou, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's been a positive season. I mean, you know, not so long ago when after the Chelsea game, I think it was, where they had they were decimated by injury and suspensions, and you thought, this is going to derail their season. I did, you know, as you always ask, are they going to finish in the top four? I think I probably started to, in the direction of Aston Villa. And what they've done in that period of time has been pretty remarkable. And it comes back to the point that Alison made about style and sort of devotion to that. and that there was a real contrast between that and what Manchester United are. You know, your mind goes back to the early weeks of Erik ten Hag's tenure. That hell of a game against Brentford, when they kind of, it's like almost immediately they threw the philosophy and the style and the idea in the bin. You couldn't imagine Postecoglou doing that. And I know, like, there's nuance in that. Like, part of it was about realizing that David De Gea just could not possibly do that, and that some of the defenders couldn't possibly build play from the back in the way they did. Then you would say maybe he should have been as bold as Pep Guardiola was when he first came in and said, "I need to get rid of the goalkeeper now, and there's certain things I need to do immediately to shape the team in my image." And then that also would come back, you know, straight into the realm of Manchester United more broadly and the recruitment, and it's not an easy process at that club. So there's a lot of kind of conflicting forces in the modern Manchester United. But watching this game, the fundamental thing that I was struck by was Erik ten Hag has to reveal a style and a kind of a blueprint and what he really wants his team to look like very soon, or I think he's gone.
And I just that's so interesting, Gregor, because do you think, you said Ten Hag should have said, no, this isn't going to work with what I've got, I need to be bold and make changes, and this is my blueprint. But do you think it's the club that stopped, because it took him an awful long time to get a few things going there and to look moderately powerful. Do you think the club stops any personality from doing what, something like an Ange, or do you think Erik ten Hag just isn't that sort of person to have that lack of pragmatism, that ability to say, I am this and this is all you're going to get?
That's a very hard question to answer, isn't it? Because, you know, it was discussed after the game too, that Ange Postecoglou was almost making a lot of other new appointments look bad now because of this ability to, whoever steps in, however poor we think that player has been for Spurs, they kind of seem to be able to rise to the challenge and feel invested in what he's asking them to do. So he's kind of making other people look bad. But
they had an equal reputation, though, didn't they, when they were
appointed? Yeah, of course,
at the big clubs.
Yeah, of course. And there are so many, you know, vaunted names and managers who have been chewed up and spat out by Manchester United that I still fundamentally think that the club has been so negligently run and is such a mess that it would be pretty impossible. I thought, you know, I'm not even sure Ange could have come in and asked Wan-Bissaka to do the same things that Pedro Porro is doing. He could defend better than him, but he couldn't ask him to step into midfield. He doesn't. Manchester United's recruitment has been so bad over the years that they fundamentally don't have the players even that. So it's a lot of, you know, I'm conflicted but, even saying that, because Spurs had, we're playing with a group of players that you would have said the same about last season. So it is about the manager.
I think, but also the confusion, I think we're all sort of grasping around for it, is that Ten Hag had a great season last season. I mean, you know, he made set, you know, he confronted after, you know, there were some spectacular wobbles within it, obviously, at Brentford and others. But the fact is that it was a good season, and he started to make sense of a lot of things. You know, he confronted the Ronaldo issue, which was another massive indulgence mistake by a rotten recruitment department. You know, it looked like that was the first step towards, you know, a serious regime, didn't it? And I think that's part of why this feels a bit whack-a-mole at United. It's sort of, you know, you sort out one problem, then another flares up. And another conflicting thing about it is the fact that Ten Hag and his agent have been more heavily involved in the recruitment than is probably wise or healthy as well. So, you know, he's not off the hook on the involvement in the recruitment process, which is undoubtedly, you know, one of their biggest failings of the last 10 years, full stop. So I think that is the problem for the regime, the new regime that's coming in, is that Ten Hag, you know, at one minute seems part of the solution and the next minute seems part of the part of the problem.
Well, you're talking about that new regime, Matt, and leads us perfectly onto the next round of topics, because it's time to ask Dicko, because you are the man at the Times, along with Matt Lawton, who covered the Jim Ratcliffe takeover light, should we call it, at Old Trafford. We were chatting on Christmas Eve, wasn't it? And what a pleasure that was to have you on side when that news broke. And I thought, come on, Dicko, please bail me out here.
Luckily, I was only one glass of champagne into my Christmas Eve celebration, so professional to the end.
Exactly.
I jumped to action.
Produce wonderful detailed analysis. So we want to kind of have, as we've got you on, we want to talk about Jim Ratcliffe and what his plans are at Old Trafford. Tell me first about the man, because he's someone who you've known through your career, for his time in cycling and other sports, and you've got to know him, you've interviewed him a number of times. What is he like as a person?
Remarkably straightforward to deal with, in the sense of, so I mean, I go back to where I started with him. I was at a launch of the new boat as part of the America's Cup Ben Ainslie operation, and he was there, and I knew from various different bits of feedback that he wasn't a huge fan of the Times, Sunday Times, because of a lot that we'd done about tax operations around, you know, obviously they did move the company abroad. He's talked about falling out with Gordon Brown, the government, and, you know, the front end had done a lot on that. And but he was stood there and I thought, well, I'll just go up and try my luck. And I said, you know, I'm told that you're not a big fan, but I'm introducing myself. And he said, well, do you want to talk about sport or do you want to talk about tax? And obviously, you know, there are plenty of good people who know a lot more who are doing the tax. And I said, well, let's talk about sport. And that's how he operates. It's quite a straight, you know, sort of ask, you know, straightforward. The way the company's run is remarkably, you know, considering they're a 50 billion enterprise, it's sort of remarkably vertical. So there's three guys essentially running a 50 billion revenue global corporation, but there's not a sort of huge head office with reams of PRs and that level of mid management. It is sort of three guys, and there's, you know, sort of, you know, incredibly streamlined operation. And I think that hopefully, if you're a Man U fan, will be to the benefit, in the sense of they're not a group that faff around. You know, he prides himself on being this sort of straight talking northern grammar school boy, and we sort of cut the crap, basically.
Right.
That's really, it's a, you know, incredibly lean operation, and decisions get made fast, and, you know, they would say obviously not in haste, but decisions can be made fast because you're not answerable to, you know, 18 levels of corporate structure. So, yeah, I mean, that's part of my dealings with them, is that, yeah, it's straightforward, it's lean, and it's sort of to the point.
Yeah, no nonsense. But also, it strikes me that a lot of the initial kind of feelings out of United in this move is excitement for him. He talked about, in a piece Paul Hurst has written for the website, with this being one, the most exciting thing he's ever done. And I think there's been a lot of pictures going round, and, you know, him sat next to Ferguson and things. I remember going back to an interview you did with him where he kind of outlined tentatively this being an ambition to own a big football club, potentially Manchester United, one day, a long, long time ago. So there is that almost sense of fandom for him, if you
know. Absolutely. I mean, you know, grew up in Manchester, you know, sports in his bones. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that, in a way that, you know, when he's sitting there, I'm sure during those 90 minutes, he's mostly fan rather than, you know, I mean, you can't, you know, if you've just thrown 1.3 billion into it, then you'd quite like it to succeed. But there is that, yeah, there is the fandom, there is the excitement of it. I don't think, you know, the first couple of interviews we did, he said he didn't want to be silly money, so there was a wariness about the Premier League then, about getting involved. But he's turned 70. I think there's that degree of, you know, you can't take it with you. You can't take that 50 billion with you. And also, you know, let's not be too sort of soppy about it as well. There is a business, you know, they are becoming a more consumer-facing corporation, you know, producing cars and just wanting to be known in China and everywhere else. And a way to get their conclusion is that you can spend hundreds of millions on advertising, or you can buy sporting entities and get yourself known and have a whole lot more fun in the process. Now, whether Man United is going to be fun is the big question. And I think they think that, from what they see, there is a lot about the operation that can be improved very, very quickly. We've touched on recruitment probably being first on the list. You know, I think the amount that the performance side was undermined by Ed Woodward in particular is just something that needs just a colossal correction. You know, this is sort of 10 years of undermining and downgrading, you know, things, basic things like, you know, infrastructure, buildings, you know, bricks and mortar, training ground, that sort of stuff. And I think they think there's a lot that, that can be done very quickly on the performance side to drag United back to things like world class, which it hasn't been in any department for a long time.
Can I ask you, Matt? He only owns 25%. If I was Jim Radcliffe, with, you've just described a man who is hugely successful, is there any sense at all that it's slightly humiliating that that's all he's got?
Well, I'd say, I mean, you know, he is a guy that I think everyone can see that wants control. Like, you know, basically he's not used to, I mean, I'm sure he has to do all sorts of compromising in, you know, business when you're running operations on that side, or types of sort of careful negotiations, diplomacy even, to get what you want. But, and I think, I guess he's shown an arch pragmatism about his dealings with the Glazers, that he was willing to do what it takes to get a foot in the door. I mean, my strong suspicion is that this will become more than 25%. You know, this was just the Glazers dynamic was so complicated. You got these six siblings, two of whom, you know, at least, you know, vaguely care about football, others who don't seem to care less but have a huge stake in it. And it just, that dynamic was so complex that this, if this was the only way to get it over the line, I see why he's just taken a very pragmatic stance. But I would, you know, say they've got the control of the sport and operation. How those dividing lines actually play out, I think, is a big question I would have as a United fan, just to see how that does really work. But I would also suspect that Jim Ratcliffe will have more than 25%, you know, in the next year or two.
Has anyone ever thought about, from the other side, from the Glazer side, if you are still on 75%, or, well, I know there are other minority shareholders, but you're a majority shareholder, you cede control of the football operation of a football club. Like, has anyone ever thought of that from their point of view? Like, how could that just underlines how little they care about Manchester United? What, well, is anything other than an investment?
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, this is where, you know, I mean, back to yeah, I have to name Ed Woodward in this, because, you know, the lack of accountability there of just Ed Woodward spent as much time, you know, he split his time between London and Manchester. You know, David Gill would be down at the Cliff, you know, religiously every week, and we'd be there. And that was partly to meet the manager or meet other senior staff, but as partly just smelling the air. You know, it's your job as chief executive just to know what's the atmosphere here? Is this, you know, productive? Is this, where is this heading? Are people getting on? You know, just to have those sort of conversations. And you know, the 10 years after Ferguson left, bit by bit, say that just got more, you know, it did become more and more just, you know, a commercial operation with a football team attached. And yeah, that's been said many times about United, but, you know, that's because it's true, I think. I mean, it really is. You know, they did invest a lot of money in players, that's undoubtedly, but it was invested badly. So, you know, that's just beyond any doubt. And I think, but, you know, back to where Ten Hag is, he's clearly, you know, you have to ask hard questions about him. But I don't actually think, if I was taken over now, I'd want to be rushing into any Ten Hag decision. I'm saving that till the summer. You know, first of all, I'm thinking, right, I'm looking at the entire structure around it. I'm looking, much more importantly, for a world-class football director than I am thinking about, is Ten Hag, you know, the problem or not.
Yeah, well, you talked about strong suspicions, and I'm sure Manchester United fans listening will be like, give us some more strong suspicions, come on then, if you know the guy. So I'm going to ask the questions. Strong suspicions: how much money do you think they're going to be spending, in terms of, obviously within financial controls and things, but is there going to come a moment in the summer where we're suddenly going to see Manchester United spending big money?
Well, I think, I mean, my understanding is they're very tight on FFP already. I don't mean they've got the flexibility to. So, you know, again, you know, because of the colossal mistakes of you know, most of the last decade. So
it'll be about unpicking that first, do you think?
Oh, I think so. You know, and I think, you know, say getting, most important thing is getting that department sorted out, getting someone in, you know, because another massive test of Ratcliffe and obviously Dave Brailsford is going to be, you know, it's delegation. We've seen it before. It's massively exciting to be a fan who, you know, you get control of a club, but then do you have the self-discipline and the good sense to say, look, I have strong feelings about whether Casemiro should stay on or you know, him in the team, but ultimately I have to trust the experts. So that, again, it's going to be fascinating. And I think the best way that they can prove that there is a new regime in town is to bring in a world-class sporting director. You know, someone like Dan Ashworth would have been high on a list, whether you can prize him out of Newcastle, who, you know, very capable of giving him a big fat pay rise. But, you know, someone like him, you know, obviously we know the job that Michael Edwards did at Liverpool in league with Klopp, you know, and obviously Man City, you know, the Catalan regime that came in and turned that around. So, you know, United's, I think that's the first place I start. Because this is about better recruitment, not just throwing money at the problem.
Do you think, in terms of Dave Brailsford, and you mentioned him there in context of making these decisions, obviously his strong background came from the world of cycling. Is he going to be involved in the football operation running, or is he going to be liaising with a director of football?
I think it's, you know, knowing him from, you know, sort of 20 years of dealing in cycling, you know, he's a guy who will be working obsessively 24/7. So it's a sort of, it's a fine balance between, you know, he will be throwing everything at it, but also being smart enough to delegate. I mean, you know, with, you know, bringing in the best in, and I think, you know, one thing I would, you know, again, they will have to prove it, but I think they will be looking at top operators. I mean, I think they'd be mad not to be. And obviously that is the test now of the type of people they bring in to transform what's been a, you know, sort of moribund and failing operation in many ways.
And in terms of the club that they are taking charge of, particularly the football side, as Gregor says, Manchester United's a team that you've covered a lot in your career as a club, lots of dealings with Sir Alex Ferguson. You've written books about the club, including about that treble-winning team. When you look at them now, and obviously knowing Ratcliffe and the operation, where do you think they're actually at? You know, we talk so much about them, and we talk so much in respect to Ferguson. We compare them to those years, and we say they're just nowhere near it. Is there need to be a reset and kind of saying, right, we need a new football director, we need to improve Old Trafford, we need to fix the holes in the roof, we need to set up proper structures, and we also need to accept we're not going to win the title for 5 years or more?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, the most important thing is to get the right people in big positions and say there is a question mark over Ten Hag about whether he is that man, as there is over John Murtagh and various others. Am I right in thinking there's only been three managers at Man United who've ever won the league, I think? I think it is some remarkable stat like that. 22 out of 25 have effectively sort of, you know, it's a club that's both had obviously some of the greatest glories that we've seen in of any English club, and at the same time has had these long periods in the wilderness. I think, you know, the nature of modern football is that the wilderness means fifth place or sixth place, doesn't it? It's not, you know, plummeting down the divisions. It's not been relegated like they were in the 70s. But I think at the moment it just feels like there's just been the mediocrity at so many levels, isn't there? It's certainly not world, you know, this is a club that at its best you associate with innovation, with excitement, with adventure, with glamour. Those are not adjectives that have been thrown around very much at the moment.
You're talking about those kind of glory days, and it's a fascinating point because I think sometimes that's part of the problem with Manchester United. They're so wedded to that dynasty period, but that doesn't happen in football much anymore. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola perhaps might be the last two managerial dynasties at big clubs. Will Jim Ratcliffe be bringing that kind of more clinical look of maybe we'll get in a, you know, Antonio Conte type figure, we might win a couple of trophies and then it'll tail off and then we'll need a new one, the more modern way of running football clubs? Will he be that clinical, or do you think maybe because he's a fan, he sat next to Fergie in the stands, might be a bit more romantic in his views and visions?
I would lean towards the clinical. You know, you see the most successful clubs are built, we talked about this with Postecoglou coming in, they're built in a style, aren't they? There is, you know, and it's joined up. I mean, it's very hard, you know, Liverpool, they've had this dip, but they've come back, you know, reborn in still in the shape of a Klopp team. You know, City, you know, when Guardiola leaves, there's no chance of being, you know, Pep light, is there? I mean, he's such a unique force there. So I think the key question is, well, first of all, you get some senior people in who are thinking, what do we want to be? What is, you know, because I think the other thing at United is, because the rot has gone so deep and so wide in the last 10 years, you know, I mean, I know there's discussions about, you know, a cultural reboot. I mean, even among the staff, and you could say, does this really affect players on the team? But I know even at sort of dozens and dozens of staff, it's been quite a miserable place to work for a while. You had the Mason Greenwood whole episode, you know, stuff that's just, you could say that's sort of, you know, was sort of brought onto them by one person, Greenwood himself, but it was so cack-handedly handled, and it just feels like they've just lurched from just one, yeah, abject episode to another. And yeah, this is a chance for a reboot, but it's also one complicated by the fact that there is this unique co-ownership, co-management structure. And ultimately, you know, we're going to have to see how that plays out, because it would be unrealistic to think that it's not going to have tensions.
A final suspicion for you then. Eric Ten Hag himself, you kind of touched on him as a subject and his future. What do you think Jim Ratcliffe will be wanting to see from Ten Hag between now and the end of the season in relation to start sitting down in the summer and going, right, Eric, you've done enough to convince me, you're the man, let's talk about recruitment, etc. What does Ratcliffe need to see from Ten Hag? Does he need to see, you know, Champions League? Does he need to see a style, like Gregor says?
Well, I think it's, I'd say more towards the style, but then that raises a fascinating question itself, doesn't it, of whether does he think, well, actually, my best way of trying to scrape back up into top four territory is to be, you know, a sort of non-Man United counter-attack, you know, just become a counter-attack, you know, I mean, what do they have yesterday? Is it, yeah, 36% possession? You know, obviously that's partly due to Tottenham and how well they did. But does he try and become a Manchester United manager with all the sort of baggage that brings of how you sort of try and run games? Or does he just try and be sort of archly pragmatic? And all of this, having a manager in doubt is obviously going to, you know, complicate it for the players. I mean, that's part of what's going on. And I don't think anyone should be totally let off the hook here, but it can't be easy when you're at a club where you know that the sporting director is basically, you know, lame duck, where, you know, all those conversations that will be going on, where you know there's a new, you know, you've got conversations going on all the time with new ownership, a whole new management structure coming in. Now he's, you know, one minute he's answerable to Ed Woodward, then it's Richard Arnold, then, you know, Dave Brailsford and Jim Ratcliffe are coming in. I, you know, to be fair to Ten Hag, that's not a lot of fun either, to sort of have that kind of turbulence constantly swirling around in the background.
Will anything happen in January, in the January window, to sort of send a signal to fans that this is what we want from the next?
Well,
half
trouble is,
of the,
I mean, officially the approval won't go through till early February at the earliest, because obviously they're still waiting on the Premier League. Now, you know, Dave Brailsford and Jim Ratcliffe was there yesterday, and, you know, Ineos are in the building, but formally it doesn't go through till early January. Say, as my understanding is that in terms of spending, they are on the limit, and that they're going to have to be smart with some, you know, obviously they were trying to sell Maguire, didn't happen. You know, McTominay, who then becomes one of their better players of the season, was you know, on the out list at one point. So it's difficult for them to suddenly just sort of throw money at the problem.
But that conversation is a tricky one to imagine. So does Ten Hag say to Jim Ratcliffe, "Well, what do you want me to do then?" Or does Ratcliffe say to Ten Hag, "I want you to do this"? Who decides what the way forward is with no spending? Is it just get to the top four, come what may, doesn't matter how lacking in entertainment is? Or does Jim Ratcliffe say, "I'd like to see something different"?
I think with Dave Brailsford having those conversations more. You don't think so? I think he's someone who will look at like the overarching vision of what best practice success in modern football looks like. And that's the kind of conversation I would hope that he would be having with Ten Hag. And you'd hope there'd be some synergy there. And like, whatever's gone on before, say, look, maybe you can maybe say, look back to what I did at Ajax. And that's the kind of, that's the vision I have for a modern football club. And that's just, surely Manchester United fans must desperately hope that that's what the, that's what this investment is going to bring ultimately, is more of a sort of, more of a vision. There's been no vision apart from making money.
Would you agree with that, Matt?
Absolutely. No, no, couldn't. Yeah, well put. I mean, it's and but also that's that vision. You know, is going to be interesting because, you know, if you say, if you are bringing in a, you know, a sporting director of clout, then they'll have theirs as well, their own views about what type of club it should be and what type of coach can fulfil that. But no, I think that the first questions are about really defining a new strategy of what the club is trying to be. And, you know, and I think Ten Hag could yet turn it around. I think he is a serious coach. As you say, what he did at Ajax was impressive. I'm not writing him off yet, but I'd think he is. He does seem to, you know, we can see it on the pitch. He seems to be flailing around himself a bit as to what exactly the overarching strategy is.
Absolutely fascinating insight, Matt. And for more detailed insight from Matt and the rest of the Times team, make sure you're subscribed. That detailed insight will likely include the latest on Everton and Nottingham Forest and a potential spending breach, which I'm sure we'll be discussing on Thursday. For now, stick with us. Up next, we're talking about Saturday's thriller at St James's Park.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Matt Dickinson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. To St James's Park then, and a Manchester City comeback, which is fairly ominous for the rest of the league. But more importantly, for neutrals like me, oh, there were some lovely goals, weren't they? Oh, absolutely lovely, lovely football goals. Maybe the most aesthetically pleasing five goals ever scored in a match. Alison Rudd, would you agree?
Yeah, no, it wasn't a single dud, was there?
What are our favourites? Come on, who's... I'm gonna pick De Bruyne's. There aren't, just because it's the most Kevin De Bruyne thing ever, isn't it? To come back into the Premier League and side foot a ball into the bottom corner through a defender's legs from outside the box. Surely he's about the only player in the world who could do that.
I would argue that the most Kevin De Bruyne thing was his assist.
Yes.
Mm. Like a kind of an arcing ball that no one else could pick out under the most, you know, extreme pressure at the moment. That
Is that your favourite of the five then, Oscar Bob's winner?
I think so, because I also love the finish, the way he shuffled his feet around the goalkeeper.
I'll have to go Bernardo then, aren't I? Someone's going to have to.
I mean, it's really good. It made me think, looking back at that goal and remembering the Kanu one for Arsenal, which I think was against Middlesbrough away. And when he scored that, I remember it being like, oh my God, how has a footballer done that? But actually, we just take it for granted now that they can do this little flick between
Zola,
the legs.
Zola's one was the classic, wasn't it, as well? That was the one I sort of instantly came to my head watching it, but it's just the way it was such a perfect connection, and it was right in the corner, and it was just, and he's just such a magical little player, isn't it? That you just know that, you know, sometimes players you sort of think, oh, he's sort of almost got a bit lucky with that one, whereas with him you just think, yeah, he's measured that to the millimetre.
The Newcastle ones were beautiful as well, helped I think by the camera angle being behind both of them, so for that curling one into the far corner that they both managed to pull off.
We spent a lot of time in our living room trying to say Oscar Bob the way that Rowan Atkinson would say Oscar Bob, because he said the word Bob in what was the series called?
Blackadder.
There was a Bob in Blackadder, but we decided it's impossible to impersonate, because if you try,
give it a go,
it's impossible because he makes it sound very English. And if you
Bob.
Try and no, yeah,
but wasn't it the fe- it was if a female it, wasn't it a female character that he was caught there wasn't there wasn't that the joke that they were calling it was a female character that they was dressed up as a bloke, so that's why they were making big play of Bob.
It's impossible to say it like him, but we were trying. But I think the name Oscar Bob is Bob. It's a lovely, lovely name.
It's a great name.
Wonderful, lovely.
He's a great player.
Lovely goals, lovely players, and lovely, lovely names. But more importantly, Gregor, I'm coming to you. It's City, isn't it? Here we go. Start the car, start the train, win the league by 20 points. Here we go. It's happening,
yeah,
well, isn't
it? I mean, I won't go that far, but it's, yeah, De Bruyne, I mean.
He's quite good, isn't he, Kevin De Bruyne,
it's
I think.
Ridiculous.
For more top insight, listen to the Game podcast.
I know.
And lovely, okay, lovely hair.
Lovely
yeah,
hair.
Yeah.
Quite Jack Grealish-esque, I've got to say.
When they sat next to each other, it was rather comical.
Maybe been copying him. But anyway, back to the more serious footballing point. Because, Gregor, this is what you've been saying all season when I've been getting excited by Aston Villa and Arsenal and Liverpool are brilliant. And you've been going, just you watch, City will come. There you go, that was my impression of you.
Yeah. I mean, even I couldn't have imagined an immediate impact like this from De Bruyne, though. It's the way he always, like, there's just no fear. It's always, he kind of just strolls around in the middle of the pitch, picking up little pockets of space that he can suddenly get on the half turn or just move forward into if no one closes him. And just, like, without looking at the ball too, it's like he's always scanning around, and he plays like an incisive through ball. Just, he's just different to anyone. Yeah.
But how does he, I wanted to ask you this, Gregor, because you will have been on the pitch with players that were cut above.
Yeah, not Kevin De Bruyne, unfortunately.
No, but a cut
did
above.
Play against Iniesta and a few of the other greats, though.
Oh, well, yeah.
But what? How? Why? Why? What is going on psychologically that no one closes him down? Why does he always look like he has the space? Why?
I think that
why?
Does him a disservice,
how?
Though. I think because he, there were times where he picking the ball up almost like in a number six position, where he would just like exchange passes with, I don't know, Rodri in midfield, and just like that's just manipulating the opposition just to move around. And other times where he's almost out wide and then he drops inside from out to in into a number 10 position. I think you can always say that the defence should, you know, somebody marked Kevin De Bruyne, please, because he's Kevin De Bruyne. But when he's so like unpredictable, he's not really got. That's actually an important question now. Where is he going to play?
Well,
Phil Foden is.
Martin Hardy's written on the Times website a piece discussing what his best position is, and he almost kind of embodies that modern tactical phenomenon of there's no such thing as formations, there's no such thing as positions, is there? It's just Kevin De Bruyne, because he can play anywhere. And I'd wonder whether with Erling Haaland out as well, he becomes more important to the team as a whole. Because it felt like it all just revolved around him rather than a figurehead forward for a change. And it was fascinating to think back to that City team that won the title before Haaland, without a striker. And you wonder whether they can cope with that, because Pep will just go, hey guys, remember that, let's just go back to that for a couple of weeks, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I think you probably want to put Haaland back in the team though, Tom, that's the problem,
yeah.
When he's fit. So I think it'll depend on the opposition. You often see him tailor who he plays as the two kind of, you know, alongside Rodri. So it was Kovacic in this game. It could be De Bruyne against certain opponents and against teams who, like Newcastle, who he was giving a lot of respect to. You want to be a little bit more secure in that. And then he's got the luxury of rotating them as well. But he's just on 33, right? We do have to. I think he will still be bedded back in. These are going to be impact moments for
33 in June. But yeah,
is he okay? Sorry, yeah. Coming up 33. I don't think he's. You know, it's been a long time. Big injury. I think he will still be bedded back in. So I don't think this is a question for right now. But when you're looking at what City's strongest team is going to be when everyone's fit, it's a tough question to answer.
But what do the opposition do then? Because Newcastle were winning that game, and presumably you as the management, you know he's going to come off the bench, De Bruyne. So don't you have a plan? I mean, isn't it worth just saying to somebody?
Kick him.
Well, if you make look sure his, you don't give him the
if
space
you look at his goal, if you look
to
at his,
deliver those
if
passes.
If you look at his goal, everyone was really behind the ball. And he just saw an avenue that he ran into. And even then, when he took the shot, there was a defender immediately in front of him. He was confronted and he put it through his legs.
I don't really blame them for the goal, but I think that sort of element of deference almost. It looks like he's being given deference when he's deeper.
Do I detect a little fear in your voice as a Liverpool
fan? Maybe just a little bit. She said getting very high pitched.
Even then, the pass, like I was looking, you know, as someone who played a fullback, I was looking at Trippier thinking, you know, Bob kind of has gone on his blind side and behind, but the ball is so low and it's not like floated in behind. He didn't have any time to really recover. Bob timed the run perfectly. His control was perfect. Christ, the margins are so fine there.
And you have two people close. I mean, he's, you know, because of that whole eyes in the back of the head and that awareness thing, you know, you try and close him down and he'll be spinning, you know. They remind me of the time I tried to mark Kenny Dalglish in a press match. And basically I sort of, you know, every time I got within, you know, 6 inches, the ball and man had disappeared. And I was sort of like, is this, you know, there's some sort of magic trick going on. But it's that's the trouble, isn't it? You can swarm around him and, of course, he's just going to be pinging balls off blind, those blind passes that set other runners off.
And his two decisive moments came from central areas. But when he first came on, he was overlapping on the wing, playing crosses in. Like, this is the thing. You can't just say, unless you're going to say, man, mark him. That's quite rare nowadays. Manchester United.
But he's rare, isn't he? So maybe rare players require rare measures.
How rare is he, do we think, in the Premier League all-time thinking? Because Martin Hardy's piece, as well as discussing where he can play, ranks him all-time third in Premier League seasons for assists, 103 now since 2012. Cesc Fabregas next on the list with 111. Ryan Giggs far out in front with 162. I'm not going to ask you, oh, is he better than Gerard Lampard? Is he in that conversation? Oh, far beyond? You know, is he in a different category? Do we put him in
a
different discussion?
No. I don't think he's far behind. You've got to remember how you felt about Cesc Fabregas, for example, and how we would talk about players like that. And David Silva, not so long ago, it was like, ooh, gush, gush, gush. He is a gush, gush, gush player, but I don't...
But he's more impactful in decisive moments. It's like almost more like you would compare more to Toure. He would grab a game and win it for them. Whereas, like, you know, Cesc Fabregas was really easy in the eye, and he did that too. He did those things, but... Mm. There is something, he's more like, you know, Steven Gerrard does for Liverpool too. It's the way, it's his drive. He comes on for 14 minutes or something?
I think.
And he won them the game.
It's the weight of power. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of creative midfield players, I think you'll struggle to top him in the Premier League time. And I think to me, it's always just that weight of pass. He just seems to, you know, just have a calibration of that I think surpasses anything I've seen.
It's like those PlayStation games, isn't it, where you kind of power up and you have to hit the perfect line and then you hit the perfect shot. He seems to have that in his head.
Yeah, you see the dots going
And you're like, yes, I've lined that up perfectly. He does that every single time.
Yeah. With the force, as Matt's saying, the weight. So, you know, some people could clip that passing, but you couldn't do it with the same, you know, power. Look, there was a lot of power on that cross that kind of, you couldn't even call it a cross, that through ball. It was amazing.
Matt, easy time for you to come on the show and answer this question, because we've been debating the title race all season. And perhaps after a City comeback win, and as Gregor says, with De Bruyne back and Haaland back in a couple of weeks, as I say, Gregor's been long campaigning for the don't get too carried away, we're not in a four-team title race. Whilst me, Alisson and everyone else have been getting excited about the prospects of Liverpool, Aston Villa, Arsenal, etc. Is it going to be another City season, do you think? Go on, say no.
It's pretty hard not to say yes at this point, isn't it? Not by canter, probably, but I think you just look at the attacking options that are coming together now, and just think they are going to find a way, aren't they? I'd love to say that Aston Villa is still going to pull off a miracle, but I fear not.
Still in the hunt. But I want to talk about another team that we have debated a lot on the podcast this season, which you won't have mentioned, is Newcastle. Do you think their season now, currently as it stands, 10th in the table, another disappointing defeat, in a tough period for Eddie Howe, other than that win in the FA Cup against Sunderland, do you think this is a reflection of how they overachieved last season? Or actually, are they on a bit of a dip? And talking about previously another United with ownership and big ambitions and managerial changes potentially on the horizon. Do you think this is the Eddie Howe tenure petering out towards an end?
Well, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, I did a piece just sort of going to the new year about obviously the, you know, how much the FA will be watching this, because, you know, if you're, you know, the strong expectation, I mean, Southgate's contract finishes this year, and you know, again, strong suspicion that he will decide that that's enough after this one, and who ticks more boxes than Eddie Howe as the likely successor. And I think, well, yeah, wherever Newcastle finish, you know, he should be, you know, at the forefront of that conversation. I think that he is hitting some understandable obstacles. You know, a small squad in terms of talent depth compared to most of the Champions League rivals. You're trying to juggle that. You know, that was, you know, that the Champions League, you know, there were some absolute humdingers in that, weren't there? That takes a heck of a lot out of you. You can see it in certain players that have just dipped off. Trippier, possibly the most sort of, you know, obvious, but plenty of others who are just not struggling to hit the levels they were last year. And that's, to be honest, pretty understandable. It just feels like a team squad that is just, you know, a bit frayed and frazzled, doesn't it?
Could you see Eddie Howe as a successor to Gareth Southgate, do you think?
Well, I think he was probably the most obvious successor. Now, whether that's obviously assuming he wants to go into international management, he's still pretty young as a club coach. But, you know, certainly if you're the FA, you're monitoring Newcastle very closely, because I think, you know, with the expectations, ambitions of the ownership, they're not likely to, I suspect that they're capable of being quite ruthless if they need to be.
Indeed. We've talked a lot about club ownership and ownership models and bad ownership and good ownership and things like this. So I wanted to divert our attention away from the Premier League just for a moment. And Gregor, I wanted to talk about Reading and the extraordinary scenes there this weekend, with a fan protest leading to the abandonment of their match against Port Vale. For the kind of more, you know, casual Football League follower who will have saw this and gone, where the hell's that come from? Tell us where it's come from. What is the background to this story with Reading?
Their owner, Dai Young, has run the club in a remarkable fashion, basically. I think at one point in 2021, for every £100 in revenue, they were spending £244 on wages.
Reported £191 million in losses, but, yeah, and docked 16 points in the past 2 years.
16 points, yeah. The joke was, I wrote a piece in October, and the joke was that that's more than any team in the last 3 seasons had taken off Reading, 16 points. So their owner had taken more points off the club than any other side. Yeah, and the thing about this is there are genuine fears that, you know, there are incompetent owners, and then there are owners who are kind of some malign intent, perhaps, and that's the fear, because he has already owned two clubs, one in Belgium and one in the Chinese Super League, who no longer exist. And
was he in the Marvel franchise going around destroying football clubs? I mean, why on earth would that be your ambition?
I don't think we could talk about that on air, to be honest.
Okay.
But that is the fear. And the thing is now, you know, there have been in talks, he's been in talks with various parties about selling the club, and the kind of noise is that he's not returning to the table to continue those discussions. And there are the players, things have come up recently, like they've got some young talented players from their academy. Reading still have a very good category one academy, which might not be category one for much longer. This month they're going to have to sell, already a team full of kids, but they're going to have to sell the kids that are playing, basically. And they haven't paid a caterer, so they're eating microwave meals. They aren't paying, you know, heating bills, so the staff are sitting at their desks and offices wearing jackets. It's getting pretty scary for the fans. So this is the kind of desperate cry for help. There have been others that, you know, when I wrote that piece in October, that was just before a big march through the city in kind of protest. They've thrown tennis balls onto the pitch, which has become quite a familiar sight in the AFL, unfortunately, in recent years. They've disrupted games in the past, but this is the most sort of, you know, blatant cry for help. And the AFL have actually been, they asked for the owner to deposit, I think it was 125% of the monthly wage bill in an account, which he failed to do. So because he's also been late in paying wages. It's an absolute mess. They've come the closest to saying that this guy is a threat to the club, as they have said about any owner of a football club in the football league, I think. But he's so elusive. He's never ever given an interview. He's not attended a game for a long, long time. There are, you know, rumours about him having some money issues back in China, about getting money out of China as well. So it's very scary for Reading fans. So this was, as I say, this was really a big cry for help.
Yeah, do we condone it, do you think, around this table, the pitch invasion and the match having to be called off?
Quite importantly, the Port Vale fans who they were playing didn't.
They very much supported them,
which was a good thing to see. Port Vale have been in not a situation like this, but not too long ago. Most clubs, if you go back a decade or so, have had their own experiences of, you know, fearing for what their club might become. But Reading are very much at the forefront of that sort of fear.
Because it boils down to what is a football club? Yeah. And the football club is its fans. And if the fans have had enough, they're allowed to stay on the pitch,
well,
I think.
As a fan of a club in League One, I think Gregor alluded to it there. You always have this slight sense of fear and foreboding that this could happen to you at any point with any bad change in ownership. You know, Link and my team are very well run at the moment. We've been poorly run in the past. So if I had been there, I think I would have been standing in solidarity with the Reading fans, because you always fear. There have been so many stories. Reading aren't the only club that Gregor and I and others have talked about on this podcast and on the Times website, that bad ownership has ultimately cost the club its existence a lot of the time. So I think for me personally, I'm sure a lot of fans, as the Port Vale fans did, would stand kind of in solidarity, just because you're always fearful that this could be us at any point in my lifetime.
Would you literally stand in solidarity? Probably, stand on the pitch?
Probably. I don't know whether I'd stand on the pitch, but I'm sure a lot of the fans, you often see it at these kind of games, you know, that kind of solidarity, that understanding that we know what you're feeling, or we can imagine what you're feeling. So there might have been a standing, an applause or something like that. I don't think there's, particularly in the Football League, you can have, you know, the standard chance, you know, we can see you sneaking out, et cetera, but when it comes to these moments, I think the solidarity is pretty strong between clubs and between fans.
And we should also point out that when his takeover was completed, it was just before they were in the playoffs in the Championship. We reached the playoff final, lost to Huddersfield, I think on penalties. You know, the margins were very fine there. And since then, they've plummeted. And had one positive season, I think, in his entire tenure. And now they're in League One and looking like they're going to be in League Two next season. So he's driven the club into the ground. And to try and... We're talking about financial fair play. I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot more later in the week. But they're one of the clubs that sold the stadium to a company owned by him. So it's that, there's also the complication of... You know, when someone buys the club, they need to buy everything and associated with it, the training ground, the academy, everything like that. So it's very complex now. And he's been doing anything he can to try and kind of make up for some disastrous decisions and the excess of recent years.
I guess, we're talking about the regulator argument that keeps going around. I mean, I don't know, in this circumstance, how would a regulator have made any difference? Could, in terms of thwarting him in the first place, or measures now?
There should be more investigation of what people have done prior to takeover.
I believe he looked into buying Hull when they were in the Premier League, and the Premier League weren't happy enough for him to proceed. So there are questions for the EFL to answer about this. But it's always a difficult question. You don't know when someone arrives whether they're going to be any good or not. It's about checks and balances afterwards as well. And at any point when a club is spending, this comes back to the conversation we had with Martin Samuel on Thursday. If you're allowed unfettered spending, if you're paying £244 out for every £100 you earn, just on wages alone, what happens when they walk away? Or what happens when the money runs out? This is what happens.
Yeah, it's a remarkable situation. If you're a fan of Reading or any other club in the Football League, maybe you disagree with me on my point that we stand together, or you want to have your say, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. I'm sure it'll be a situation that we discuss in more detail as the season progresses. Returning to the Premier League, Alison Rudd, you were at Stamford Bridge, and you've written a piece on the Times website now that says Carabao Cup final looks a long way off for Chelsea and Fulham. It's a bit negative for you, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't a very enjoyable afternoon. I mean, This was a derby game between two clubs that are very close together geographically, and, you know, one's traditionally small, one's traditionally big, and they're supposed to be needle, but you would never have known it. There was very little oomph from either side, and you wouldn't have known it really from the fans either. I mean, the most eye-catching player on the pitch was Willian, who, let's face it, made his name, as far as we're concerned, with Chelsea. He was fantastic for Chelsea. His career looked to be over. Didn't have a great time at Arsenal, but has come back to Fulham and almost has the same sort of influence for Fulham that he did have for Chelsea. And the Chelsea fans, the only song they sang it twice, was the famous Willian, He Hates Tottenham song. What's, I mean, that to
couldn't
me
even
just...
muster, have they got a chant for Cole Palmer yet?
Because I mean, no, he's there's not a chant for anybody but Willian, who doesn't play for them. I mean, it is slightly ridiculous that there isn't that connection between the stands and the pitch, because there's not a lot to excite them. Chelsea are quite, as a group, they play with an immaturity. They never look fully in control of a game. They played this game back to front, so they could have got the fans on side by sort of going at Fulham, but they were very cautious. There was a lot of passing backwards, a lot of just not being overly confident. And then when they had the 1-0 lead, which they didn't deserve, it was just they were waiting for a mistake, and a mistake happened, and there was a penalty. They had the lead, and then they allowed the game to sort of get a bit out of control. So there was sort of slapstick defending towards the end, where you felt, oh, maybe Fulham should have played long balls a bit more often, because they were threatening Chelsea, and Chelsea just weren't dealing with it very well. So that, you know, it should have been the other way around. They should have gone at Fulham and then been composed at the end. Instead, they just got a bit rattled at the end. So it was, and you sort of think, God, if that is going to be the first cup final of the season, they better both improve. I'm sure if it was, it would be, but it didn't bode well.
In terms of Pochettino, because we had a big conversation around Chelsea on Thursday's show, so I don't want to dwell too much on it, but what was he like in the press conferences? And was that some, like, slightly deflated mood in Stamford Bridge to do with a slight fear about where the club are progressing? Do we think the kind of Pochettino enthusiasm is waning a little? And what was he like? Because he must be a manager that you've dealt with plenty of times.
Lots. And he was very friendly to me on Saturday, actually. I said not so much funny stuff, and he laughed uproariously, so he's very kind. But I saw before kick-off, he was in an absolute, outwardly anyway, super mood, very buoyant, very smiley, joking with people before kick-off. And yeah, they won. In the press conference afterwards, he was keen to make jokes, very smiley, very upbeat, even made jokes about the ownership. I hope I don't get any phone calls in January while I'm with my family, sort of thing. The sort of things you joke about when you're confident in your position.
Very good actor.
Well, I was going to say, he is the best actor in the Premier League if he actually feels that he's in jeopardy, because he was giving off all the vibes of someone who's very happy with life. And there's not much evidence of it on the pitch, but in his head, he feels he's making progress. That's the vibe he's giving.
Interesting. Well, thankfully, you were telling us before we started recording this podcast that there was another significant moment at Stamford Bridge off the pitch that at least gave you some entertainment. Tell us more.
Well, I don't know if it was entertainment. It was just highly unnerving, actually. So at Stamford Bridge, the press box is quite close to the pitch, and you are directly behind the subs bench. And there's a little bit of a gap, and then you're there. And in between me and the players, there was a row of men who all looked identical. They all had slicked back black hair, and they were all wearing green velvet bottle green jackets. The fact they all looked identical was kind of weird. Everyone's going, what's going on? What's going on? Turned out the owners had agreed to allow the match to be the platform for an advertisement for a new film that's coming out called Argyle, starring Henry Cavill. And so these blokes were all...
Not about Plymouth, Argyle, just to be clear.
Weirdly, no, it's a thriller. It's a thriller about...
Definitely not about Plymouth.
An author who writes thrillers and then sees real life imitating her art. And
sounds like one of your novels.
A little bit. But... So they were all Henry Cavill lookalikes, stood there, but sat there. And then, like, sort of 25 minutes in, they all stood up. There were about five of them. They all stood up. So you can see the players, and then behind them, these men stand up, and they start brushing their teeth.
What?
As a gimmick. And then And then sort of 40 minutes in, they all stand up and they're all reading the same book dramatically, if you can read a book dramatically.
When you say standing up, are they blocking people's view behind them?
Yes.
Blimey.
And then at halftime, they show clips of the film on the big screen and they try talking about it to the fans on the PA system, but the PA system is so rubbish, you couldn't actually hear what was going on. So most people in the stadium would have thought, I don't know why that's happening. It's really spooky. It was really unnerving. Also, it was bitterly cold and they just weren't warm enough. And you just thought, why? How much are they getting paid to do this?
That, I mean, this is big games gone territory, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Brushing your teeth behind Mauricio Pochettino to promote a film.
Very strange. So you would list that as the most disconcerting thing you've ever
most
seen at
unnerving
a football match? Unnerving.
Yes.
Matt, can you top it? Unnerving things you've seen at football matches?
Well, in terms of press box, certainly unnerved by him. I'm pretty sure it must have been the 1994 FA Cup final when there was one rabid Man United fan in the press box and one rabid Chelsea fan in the press box, and you can probably guess what happened next. There was what began as an argument ends up with a fist fight, as far as I remember. And I think when it was the classic, you know, you normally get at the end of a game, you get the sort of arrest count, you know, certainly a big game at Wembley, like a cup final, and it was like, you know, 7 arrests, 2 in the press box, basically. But yeah, it was that got a bit out of hand. There was another actually time when I saw there was one at Stamford Bridge where there was pretty much a coming to blows. So yeah, in terms of disconcerting things, seeing journalists beat each other up, I guess, is up there.
Gregor?
I can't compete with either of those, I'm sorry.
I was waiting for you to answer. I was always too much of a professional when I was on the pitch, never looking at the crowd. I mean, in terms of, it wasn't in the press box, but it was as a fan, when I was a student. I've told this story many times, going to an England game in South Africa, a bit of a low ebb generally as a group because of following England at that tournament was a bit disappointing, and I had been bought by my flatmates as a joke some heart-shaped diamante nipple tassels from Anne Summers.
I'm very disconcerted.
I've definitely told this story on the
most
podcast.
Most disconcerting things you hear on the podcast.
But I'm telling it again. Apologies to all my mates who listen to this podcast who've heard this story 95 times and decided to, you know, lift everyone's spirits. I thought I'd wear the heart-shaped nipple tassels topless into the ground. So I had I Heart Ing, I Heart SA on my front. And then I decided to get my mates to write in red face paint, "We still believe" on my back, ... because we obviously needed to win the game against Slovenia, I think, to progress. Got into the ground, had a few beers. The beers started to kind of wear off and I realised, Christ, I'm topless wearing heart-shaped nipple tassels at a football match. But then thankfully I realised I was not alone in the fancy dress stakes because amazingly directly behind me were 4 blokes in St. George's flag, you know, all costumed, they call them gimp outfits or whatever, you know, all body, face covered, everything.
Are you sure you're at a football game?
This was the World Cup. Well, you say about sex parties, behind them were 4 people dressed as Fabio Capello. And so I then realised we were behind the goal. And I realised that I saw a few photographers kind of spotting this collection of people, including me, and I thought, might as well embrace this. So started kind of giving it arms out and everything like that. And so actually the first time I ever appeared in a national newspaper was not bylined, was not for any of my work, but it was pictured on page 3 and page 2 of The Sun the day next day later.
You need to find that.
Pictures available on request, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Happy to provide the proof.
How much are they going for on eBay?
My mum has bought them all and is proudly displaying them in the living room back home.
Pictures also available on various darknet websites. Yeah.
But no, it was very strange to walk into the ground, as I say, of having a bit of a laugh outside and a few pictures taken with people coming up to me going, "Oh, can I have a picture? Oh, yeah, I'm wearing nipple tassels." Oh, that's very funny. And then, as I say, get in and there's 4 people. I was like, it's like someone had set it up because there was me in front, "We Still Believe" on my back. There's a picture of me turned around, "We Still Believe," my arms out, and it looks like I'm kind of conducting these 4 blokes dressed as Fabio Capello in kind of song. It's very atmospheric. But as I say,
"We Still Believe" was probably the daftest thing in the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Especially what happened after that. But as I say, I'm very happy to provide proof on request to any listeners who want to get in touch. Or maybe you want to get in touch about any of the subjects on the podcast today. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Alison Rudd, Matt Dickinson, Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday with plenty more to discuss, I'm sure.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.